The condensation on the glass of my third gin and tonic was the only thing keeping me grounded as the neon lights of the hotel bar blurred into a smear of predatory gold and predatory blue. I remember the weight of the air in that suite, stale, recycled HVAC oxygen mixed with the metallic tang of his expensive cologne and the sharp ozone scent of a storm breaking over the Chicago skyline outside. We were celebrating a seven-figure contract, the kind of win that makes you feel invincible. The kind of win that makes you think the rules of gravity don't apply to a top-tier account executive. Mark sat across from me, his tie loosened just enough to look approachable, his smile just wide enough to hide the trap. I remember laughing at something he said, some hollow joke about quarterly projections. And then the world tilted. The mistake wasn't just the physical lapse in judgment, the blurring of lines between professional triumph and personal disintegration. The mistake was believing that a man like Mark ever does anything without a secondary, tertiary, and quaternary motive. I woke up the next morning with a skull-splitting headache and a sense of hollow dread, but the room was empty. No note, no lingering presence, just the clinical white sheets and the hum of the mini-fridge. I thought I had gotten away with it. I thought we would just go back to the office, bury the memory under a mountain of spreadsheets, and pretend the Chicago trip was just another successful bullet point on our performance reviews. The first reminder didn't come in an envelope or a sinister phone call. It came 3 weeks later during a Monday morning pipeline review. We were sitting in the glass-walled conference room, the sun hitting the mahogany table with a surgical glare. Mark was presenting the Q3 forecast when he paused, his eyes sliding toward me with a casual, terrifying familiarity. He didn't say a word about the hotel. He just leaned back, tapped his stylus against his tablet, and mentioned how some people find it difficult to maintain their public image when the lights go out. He smiled, that same golden blue neon smile from Chicago, and asked me if I could adjust the margin reports for the Northeast Territory. I told him the margins were fixed, that the auditors would flag a 3% shift immediately. He didn't argue. He just pulled up a file on his tablet, turned the screen toward me for a fraction of a second, just long enough for me to see the edge of a headboard, the curve of my own shoulder, the undeniable wreckage of my own reputation captured in a high-resolution still I never saw him take. He didn't threaten me. He didn't have to. He just reminded me that he owned the narrative of who I was, and that the woman the board saw, the rising star, the untouchable closer, existed only as long as he allowed her to. The help he requested started small, a slow erosion of my professional ethics that felt like death by a thousand paper cuts, a shifted decimal point here, a bypassed compliance check there. Each time I tried to push back, each time I felt the bile of my own cowardice rising in my throat, he would simply lean against my doorframe and ask how my husband was enjoying the new house. He'd comment on how fragile the market was, how a single scandal could liquidate a career faster than a margin call. I became his ghostwriter, his shadow, the invisible hand that smoothed over his incompetence and inflated his wins. I watched him get promoted to senior VP on the back of data I had cooked to perfection. My hair started thinning. I stopped eating anything that wasn't liquid or processed. The sound of a Slack notification from him started feeling like a physical blow to the solar plexus, a sharp, vibrating reminder that the leash was still taut. I was a technical specialist in my field, a master of logistics and market penetration. Yet I couldn't find a single exit strategy that didn't involve my own total annihilation. I looked at the photo in my mind every night, the way I looked so small, so unaware of the lens. It wasn't just a picture. It was a deed of sale. The breaking point arrived in the form of the Henderson merger. It was the biggest play in the firm's history, a move that would either solidify us as a global powerhouse or trigger a series of SEC investigations that would bury everyone involved. Mark walked into my office at 7 p.m. on a Friday, the cleaning crews already buffing the floors in the hallway with a rhythmic, hypnotic drone. He dropped a thumb drive on my desk and told me he needed the Henderson valuation dropped by 20% before the morning briefing. I told him it was impossible. I told him the numbers were already baked into the prospectus. that a 20% swing would be a flashing red light for every regulator from here to DC. He didn't even look at me this time. He just stood by the window, watching the city lights, and told me he had found a way to sync the Chicago photo with the company's internal server. He said it would be a shame if a glitch caused it to populate on the home screen of every terminal in the building. He gave me 12 hours to decide if I wanted to be a felon or a social pariah. I spent the night in the office, the blue light of the monitor searing into my retinas until they bled. I looked at the thumb drive, a small piece of plastic that represented the final nail in the coffin of my soul. I realized then that Mark wasn't just a predator. He was a parasite that had finally outgrown its host. If I did this, I wasn't just helping him. I was becoming him. I was weaving myself into the very fabric of the crime, ensuring that when the house of cards eventually collapsed, and they always do, I would be the one holding the match. My secret flaw has always been my pride, the desperate need to be seen as the most capable person in the room, the one who never breaks. But as the sun began to bleed over the horizon, painting the office in shades of bruised purple and sickly orange, I understood that my pride was the very thing he was using to keep me in the cage. He knew I'd rather be his slave than be seen as a failure. He knew I'd rather rot from the inside out than let the world see me as human, flawed, and compromised. I began to type, but I wasn't changing the Henderson valuation. I was opening the back-end architecture of our cloud storage, the deep-level directories where the glitches he threatened usually lived. My fingers moved with a frantic technical precision, bypassing the admin logs I had helped him set up. I found the file. He hadn't just taken one photo. He had a gallery, a systematic collection of my most vulnerable moments, categorized with the cold clinical detachment of a man filing taxes. I felt a wave of nausea so intense I had to grip the edge of the desk to keep from sliding off the chair. It wasn't just about Chicago anymore. He had been recording our help sessions, our hushed conversations about the margins, the way I looked when I realized I was trapped. He was building a masterpiece of mutual assured destruction, a digital noose that he could tighten at any moment. The air in the office felt thick, like I was breathing underwater, the silence of the empty floor amplified by the hum of the servers. At 6:30 a.m., Mark walked in, smelling of peppermint and ambition. He didn't ask if it was done. He just reached for the thumb drive. I didn't give it to him. I looked him in the eye for the first time in months, my heart hammering against my ribs like a trapped bird. I told him the file was gone. I told him I had scrubbed the server and the drive, and that if he tried to find the backups, he'd trigger an automated alert to the CTO's personal mobile. His face didn't change at first. He just stood there, his shadow stretching long and distorted across the carpet. Then he laughed. It wasn't a villainous laugh. It was a weary, patronizing chuckle. He reached into his pocket and pulled out a second thumb drive, identical to the first. He told me I was a technical specialist, but he was a student of human nature. He told me he knew I'd try to delete it. He told me he had already sent the glitch to a scheduled delivery service, an email that would go out to the entire board, the press, and my husband in exactly 30 minutes, unless he entered a deactivation code that only he possessed. The silence that followed was the loudest thing I have ever heard. I looked at the clock. 6:32 a.m. The world was waking up, the commuters starting their engines, the coffee shops opening their doors, all of them completely unaware that my entire existence was about to be incinerated in a burst of digital packets. Mark sat in my chair, propped his feet up on my desk, and held the second drive between two fingers like a communion wafer. He told me he didn't want the Henderson valuation changed anymore. He had a better idea. He wanted me to sign a confession, a detailed account of how I had been embezzling funds and falsifying reports for the last year, all on my own, all without his knowledge. He told me that if I signed it, the email wouldn't go out. He'd let me resign quietly. He'd let me keep the house. He'd let me keep my husband as long as I left the industry and never looked back. He put a single sheet of paper on the desk and a pen. I looked at the pen, the gold nib reflecting the harsh overhead lights. And then I looked at the clock. 28 minutes left. The trap was finally perfectly closed.